Hello and welcome to the Hotchkiss and Wiley Q1 2022 High Yield Market Update. My name is John Hossie and I'm joined today by Mark Hudoff, Portfolio Manager on the High Yield Strategy. Today we will be providing an update on performance during the first quarter and our assessment of the high yield market more generally as we look ahead. Before we begin, a few disclosures. This podcast is for general information only and should not be relied on for investment advice or recommendation of any particular security, strategy, or investment product. The portfolio manager's views and opinions expressed in this podcast are as of April 13th, 2022. Such views are subject to change and may differ from others in the firm or the firm as a whole. The portfolio manager's comments include some estimated and/or forecasted views, which are believed to be based on reasonable assumptions within the bounds of current and historical information. However, there is no guarantee that any estimates, forecasts, or views will be realized. In the event of new information or changed circumstances, Hotchkiss & Wiley reserves the right to change its investment perspective and outlook. So, Mark, our high yield strategy outperformed the ICE B of A High Yield Index during the first quarter on both a gross and net of fee basis. Can you talk about some of the key performance drivers during the quarter?
The big picture, it was a tough quarter for credit. Inflation really started to take off. The Fed realized that they're pretty far behind the curve and moved from neutral to tightening, both kind of explicitly in their March meeting by raising the overnight rate and also implicitly by starting the process of unwinding QE. Russia invaded the Ukraine, the entire term structure of rates at Treasury backed up in a really nasty bear flattener. Basically, all risk assets were affected, including the equity market, which is down. It went into correction territory by mid-March. The high yield strategy at Hotchkiss & Wiley was not immune to this turbulence. I mean, as you said, net-net, we were able to perform. On balance, we're pleased by that, especially since our strategy soundly outperformed the small and mid-size kind of high yield universe. The relative performance is really driven by some steps that we've taken over the past several quarters. Namely, we've been managing our duration under the benchmark, which was good against the bear flattener. We really anticipated that the Fed would ultimately have to get serious about inflation, and actually that started to manifest itself in a rate move. We also have been harvesting for the past several quarters long duration kind of rising star ideas that we picked up in 2020. Also actively adding bank debt positions, kind of ending the quarter, you know, 7%+ in bank debt. That was a pretty insulated trade relative to the bear flattener. And also putting money to work, proceeds from those long duration ideas in higher quality single B credits. It's been our experience that single B is kind of the sweet spot when rates back up, in the sense that it's pretty immune to treasury moves, has very much one of the lowest correlations versus treasury moves, and yet you're still getting compensated from a spread point of view. So this kind of combination of shorter than benchmark, bank debt, high quality, you know, single Bs, SMIDs provided a strong relative performance for the quarter. If I look at what at a sector level, what worked and what was really the drivers, I would say that three things come to mind. I mean, energy, pretty balanced across oil field services, E&P, refining, accounted to nearly 60% of the outperformance. Now, energy outperformed broadly versus the benchmark, but we actually outperformed energy. Now, we didn't outperform basic materials, and we do have a broad overweight, but within that sector, metals and mining, really a bright star on performance. Actually, that subsector within the basic materials sector of the market was, you know, accounted for about 25% of the outperformance versus the benchmark. Consumer goods and avoiding long duration double Bs and kind of overweights and SMIDs all kind of wrapped up the relative outperformance.
Now, I've noticed that we've got a small position in investment grade, and the investment grade index underperformed the high yield index during the quarter, but our investment grade position seemed to outperform. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's funny, relative performance versus IG, it really comes down to a couple of things. First of all, I already mentioned the bear flattener, but high yield tends to be a relatively short index. Now, I'm going to broadly talk about high yield outperformance versus IG, and then I'll specifically talk about the triple B component, but because it's all kind of wrapped together. The shorter duration by quarter end, you know, duration in high yield was about 4.2, triple B duration. So the investment grade aspect was about 7.8 or 86% higher than high yield. high yield also involves credit risk. IG is much less sensitive to credit risk in the form of defaults. They're much more tied to sector rotation, themes about the liquidity, financial constraints in the marketplace, those kind of bigger picture ideas. In the case of the quarter, you saw spreads kind of back up uniformly for investment grade as well as high yield. In fact, you know, single Bs backed up about 31 basis points wider for the quarter, and triple Bs were 32 basis points wider for the quarter. So actually, the spreads widened more in triple Bs than they did in single Bs, and they had 86% more duration than the high yield market. So the combination of the bear flattener, the much longer duration in high grade, that really explains why high grade was kind of crushed versus high yield in the quarter. Our specific trades, we underwrote some duration risk in that basket because we know the correlation is about 100%, but they were relatively short to the benchmark in the high grade bucket. They also benefited, our credits did not undergo this kind of spread widening, and really that's centered on the energy space. You know, I can look at energy bonds. Some of the energy bonds didn't really move at all, even though treasuries backed up. We saw huge moves across the curve, you know, 100 basis points plus minus from twos to tens. And our bonds kind of held in there. So it's a combination of, we didn't have the same duration as the benchmark IG component. It was shorter than the benchmark duration. And the second thing is, we really didn't experience the same kind of spread widening that the broad IG component of the high yield index had. We were much more disengaged from spread widening because the fundamentals in the energy market were so strong during the whole first quarter.
Understood. Now, inflation is clearly a problem, and the Fed is preparing to aggressively contend with inflation. Can you talk about how our preference for asset coverage and more senior parts of the capital structure could help should the Fed tighten the U.S. into an economic slowdown?
Yeah, I mean, first, I think you got to kind of start with the big picture there. We're kind of entering into the last three quarters of 2022, confronting two possible scenarios. One of those scenarios is a soft landing where the Fed's able to kind of contain inflation by raising overnight rates and using all the levers they have, kind of decelerating the economy, but not tipping it into recession. So soft landing versus hard landing. I mean, that's our mainline scenario or expectation right now. We think that because the economy kind of starts at a good spot, that being good balance sheets across corporate America and consumer America, as well as very full employment, which is unusual for these periods of time. We think that the Fed should be able to thread the needle and engineer a soft landing. I mean, if you look at spreads, that's what they're telling you the expectation in the market is. They're not forecasting a recession. The reality is, though, the Fed has never had a great track record in managing soft landings. I mean, they tend to get behind the curve, and they tend to, you know, overdo it on the tightening, and the lag with policy ends up in an overshoot. That said, they should be able to manage it, we think, given the circumstances. Historically, 2000, the TMT crisis, the great financial crisis with the housing bubble. I mean, those were all bubbles that were inadvertently kind of popped through raising rates. And that created a lot of collateral damage and contracted the economy beyond just moving overnight rates up. We think this time is a little different, and we don't see any of those excesses. Really, the only obvious excess that you can see is the way money has been printed and the size of the balance sheet. And the Fed is pretty committed, I think, to managing those down. That seems like a controllable and modest excess, if you will. So why senior? Well, if you got these two scenarios, why senior in the capital structure? You got these two scenarios where we got soft landing, that's our expectation. You got a hard landing, which is a recession. We don't think that that's in the cards yet, but it's a possibility for 2023, certainly. Particularly, I mentioned 7% in bank debt. Bank debt, senior in the capital structure, very short duration, in, you know, 3 months basically, and resets, is very immune to inflationary considerations. It's also relatively immune to credit events in terms of outcome. And so we've been adding that. We've also been adding first lien paper in the bond market where it becomes available. And by the way, these kinds of times of turbulence, they tend to issue first lien bonds that we've always historically found very attractive. Why is that? Why is it helpful? Well, against this confronting two scenarios, if we go into a soft landing, this paper is the bank debt. We'll want to rotate out of that bank debt into bonds, into what we would think would be kind of a spread tightening environment ultimately after inflation gets resolved. And so it gives you those kind of degrees of freedom and flexibility. If you do go into recession, you're going to want to rotate out of the bank debt again, preserving the secure stature in the portfolio because it's much more insulated from defaults. And so this idea of being senior in the capital structure, going into these potential uncertain periods of time, has historically aided us. The bank debt, that's the largest kind of exposure we've had to bank debt in the history of this strategy. And so it's very telling that we're trying to insulate ourselves from this near-term inflation problem, you know, kind of batten down the hatches from a credit point of view because of the seniority in bank debt, but recognize that we will have to kind of move out of bank debt because if the Fed engineers a soft landing, that means overnight rates are going to have to come down eventually. And that is a bad place to be in bank debt. So we're going to have to be a little nimble in the next three quarters to a year because the bond market will reflect the overnight rate and you'll probably end up with a steep curve. So the bond market will still have elevated yields and the front end of the bank debt market will just collapse if the Fed cuts rates in response to victory over inflation. So we do have a bit of a nimble trade ahead of us, and that's why we've kept it under 10%. You know, the seniority is kind of the insulation against a bad outcome in the case of a hard landing. The floating rate nature of the bank debt is an insulation against the inflation in the front end, but we know we'll have to trade out of that down the road if we do get into a soft landing.
There is a fair amount of economic sensitivity in the portfolio. Should the Fed overcorrect and we do end up in a hard landing scenario, is that, would you be looking to take some of the risk off the table there with in terms of some of our heavier weights, for instance, energy and basic industry are two of our heavier weights. Is that a place where you'd look to take some risk off if warranted?
Well, I think it is. I mean, you know, energy is really kind of an island right now. I mean, basic materials for sure, because that's going to be very much macroeconomically driven by cyclical considerations. Energy always is sensitive to that too. So I'm not saying that it's totally disengaged, but you do have a supply demand problem going on globally. The United States flat out has done a lot of things that has made it more difficult to produce natural resources. And so that's constrained supply. Obviously, Russia is creating some real drama in that. And that conflict doesn't look like it's going to be over anytime soon. So you have this constrained supply. Even OPEC is having a hard time meeting their supply targets. In fact, perennially having a hard time meeting their targets. And at the same time, you have this kind of shift back in demand globally. And, you know, everyone wants to move into renewables, but it takes time and we don't really have the infrastructure. And it's not, and in many cases, renewables are not a particularly dependable energy source. So, you know, I think you got to look at that as a decades long transition. But everyone, after the depths of the pandemic, wants to get back. So we think that of the two real overweights we have, the basic materials, particularly some of the subsectors in their autos, et cetera, that are very cyclical, would definitely be something that we would start to shed. And we have been doing that. Energy, probably let it run a little bit because we just think that the fundamentals are so strong. Now, if we go into a global recession, that supply demand thing becomes kind of less pressing. And we definitely could see WTI and Brent down. But it, you know, that we think we have several months to work on that problem before it becomes something where we have to make a choice. And we've moved our energy. We've rebalanced the energy position a lot of ways. I mean, we've kind of, as I mentioned, we kind of culled some of the rising stars, the longer duration rising stars. We really have very modest exposure to small EMP, which is something that can really be a problem in a downturn in the oil markets. And so we have kind of middle of the road, a broad portfolio that includes EMP, oil field services, midstream assets, even some refining assets. So it's a much more broad exposure to energy, and it would be relatively easy to just scale it back if the Fed really starts to look like they're having a problem managing the soft landing.
Thanks. And last year, 2021, was a pretty strong year for high yield new issuance. What are you seeing so far in 2022?
Well, like we did in our quarterly update to, you know, we assess the fundamentals, technicals, and valuations. I mean, we took the technicals down in high yield to below average because, you know, I think we did just under $6 billion in high-yield issuance in the first quarter. That's like 95% below what it was in the first quarter of 2021. I mean, that's one of the lowest first day quarterly issuances in the history of high yield. I mean, going back to the early days when $6 billion was a real number. So we've seen a complete dearth in supply. We've also seen a lot of outflows. I mean, I think we've taken $25 billion in outflows in the first quarter. So add to that, the QE...
Just to clarify, that $25 billion in outflows is in the high yield market more broadly.
Yeah. No, not at Hotchkiss, obviously. But add to that the reduction in the QE component, which means it withdraw massive amounts of liquidity from all fixed income markets, particularly the investment grade component. It just puts a pinch on dealers. It puts a pinch on individual participants in the marketplace. Rates moving up has the same effect. So you have some policy pressure that translates probably into some liquidity pressure. You have lack of supply, and you have outflow. So it's been a pretty punishing technical picture in the first quarter. And we don't, you know, at a certain point, the supply thing, particularly we've seen a building calendar of LBOs. I mean, they're going to have to come to market. That said, some of this is being defeased into the bank debt market. The CLO market is still pretty robust, irrespective of what's going on in the rest of the world. And the private credit markets are also defeased parts of the high yield market when necessary. So I don't want to be alarmist in terms of the technical conditions. That's why we took them below average, but not to the maximum worst. But they have definitely deteriorated, and we don't really see any catalyst to improve that in the near term as we move into 22.
Now, you highlighted the technicals. What about the fundamentals and valuation and how your overall score looks today versus the end of 2021?
Fundamentals we took down to kind of average, and it's really things that I've already discussed. We think the headwind to growth is going to be the demand destruction from inflation and the supply chain friction, this policy transition, and the corresponding deterioration in financial conditions. You know, the hot conflict in Ukraine, I mean, that doesn't help any of our European or other people that are exposed directly to that part of the world. So that's going to definitely be a headwind and kind of weaken the fundamentals. I mean, I've also mentioned, though, that we're coming from a strong base. I mean, much different than 2006, 2007, or 99, you know, strong employment status, good aggregate demand to start with, very strong balance sheets across the board. So we just see that kind of year on year, we've definitely seen a deterioration, but it's kind of about average right now. I mean, I want to emphasize something about default rates. I mean, that's always the thief to high yield returns. And I don't see for balance sheet and overall economic conditions, don't see that becoming a problem in 22 really at all. I mean, we ended the quarter kind of at 50 basis points on trailing 12-month default rates in high yield. That's a stunningly low number. I mean, stunningly low number. I mean, maybe it gets to 75 basis points or, you know, in under a deteriorating economy situation at the end of the year to 1%. But the default thief is going to remain relatively contained, I think, in 2022, which really modulates our are concerned about the fundamentals. So we're kind of on average, taking them down from above average to average on the fundamentals. Valuation, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, valuation is telling you that the Fed is going to engineer a soft landing. I mean, we've seen spreads back up, not to the degree that the wides we saw in mid-March, but yeah, we're just under 400 basis points in the broad market in terms of spread off Treasury. Long-term average or kind of contemporary long average is about 500 over. So you're under the long-term average, but still pretty compelling relative to alternatives, especially given the short duration of the asset. But it's not jump up and down kind of valuation, right? It's still under average. If we get into a soft landing, there's definitely upside to a substantial tightening in spreads. But we got to kind of wait out the implications of the Fed policy before we'll see that. So we kind of see it as kind of a holding pattern. So valuations, we kind of move those up to average from kind of tighter conditions earlier. So I think that on balance, you have average fundamentals, you have weaker technicals, and the valuation has improved. So two out of the three has kind of deteriorated a little bit, but valuation has kind of improved, kind of giving a balance that's, I think, relative to other fixed income instruments, still gives you a pretty compelling argument for high yield. I don't think at this point you load the boat, especially given the very, not immaterial possibility that we go into recession, in which case spreads will definitely go wider than the average. That said, given all the other things I've talked about in terms of balance sheet and things like that, unless this takes years to get into a recession, it probably should be a pretty modest kind of slowdown and sub-zero growth. So that would be our expectation of a hard landing, not a cataclysmic hard landing like the global financial crisis, not even an aggregate demand kind of peel back like we saw in 2020 as a result of the broad stoppage of the world during the pandemic, but something much more modest, in which case defaults will ultimately move up, but it probably should be relatively manageable.
And still status quo in the portfolio in terms of your mid cap holdings?
Yeah, we've been paying very close attention to the spreads there. They're actually about average to large cap. So, you know, there's no real yellow light flashing there in terms of SMIDs being tight to large caps. They perform pretty well. Obviously, they outperform the broad market. I think it was about 40 basis points. But no, we're going to stick to our strategy and continue to invest in SMIDs. That said, given the two scenarios, in a soft landing rally, large caps probably will be the first leg up. And so if we're confronted with two credits, SMID versus larger cap, same kind of fundamentals and same kind of valuation, or very similar valuation, we probably would take the large cap. One of the key tenets we're kind of trying to focus on right now is liquidity and flexibility in the portfolio, so that if we end up in a scenario that we don't anticipate, we're able to kind of toggle into, you know, strategies that we think are supportive and preserve capital. And so one of those things is not getting too overweight in the SMID space, because it can have some liquidity requirements in a recession. And we want to kind of avoid that. So we're paying attention to it. No flashing yellow light there, just kind of like spreads. It's kind of telling you that the market expects, the high yield market at least, expects the Fed to thread the needle. And we haven't seen excesses in terms of the tights of SMIDs versus large caps, which is another, you know, reasonably healthy indicator. So stay the course. But we definitely are emphasizing liquidity and flexibility, and in which case, you know, we're not going out over a way to buy SMIDs, that's for sure.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, Mark, and I think that's a pretty good place to stop this quarter. Appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
And we thank our audience for your interest in the Hotchkiss & Wiley High Yield Strategy. For further information, please visit www.hwcm.com or call us at 888-596-4926. Thank you.